examining the errors. With the similarities in the way Greek letters are written and with the primitive conditions under which the scribes worked, it would seem inevitable that copying errors would creep into the text, I said.
Quite so,
Metzger conceded. And in fact, aren't there literally tens of thousands of variations among the ancient manuscripts that we have?
Quite so.
Doesn't that therefore mean that we can't trust them? I asked, sounding more accusatory than inquisitive.
No, sir, it does not, Metzger replied firmly. First, let me say this. Eyeglasses weren't invented until 1373 in Venice, and I'm sure that astigmatism existed among the ancient scribes. That was compounded by the fact that it was difficult, under any circumstances, to read faded manuscripts on which some of the ink had flaked away. And there were other hazards, inattentiveness on the part of scribes, for example. So yes, although for the most part scribes were scrupulously careful, errors did creep in. But, he was quick to add, there are factors counteracting that. For example, sometimes the scribe's memory would play tricks on him. Between the time it took for him to look at the text and then to write down the words, the order of words might get shifted. He may write down the right words, but in the wrong sequence. This is nothing to be alarmed at, because Greek, unlike English, is an inflected language.
Meaning, I prompted him.
Meaning, it makes a whale of a difference in English if you say dog bites man or man bites dog. Sequence matters in English, but in Greek it doesn't. One word functions as the subject of the sentence regardless of where it stands in the sequence. Consequently, the meaning of the sentence isn't distorted if the words are out of what we consider to be the right order. So, yes, some variations among manuscripts exist, but generally they're inconsequential variations like that. Differences in spelling would be another example.
Still, the high number of variants or differences among manuscripts was troubling. I had seen estimates as high as 200,000 of them. However, Metzger downplayed the significance of that figure.
The number sounds big, but it's a bit misleading because of the way variants are counted, he said.
He explained that if a single word is misspelled in 2,000 manuscripts, that's counted as 2,000 variants. I keyed in on the most important issue. How many doctrines of the church are in jeopardy because of variants?
I don't know of any doctrine that is in jeopardy, he responded confidently.
None?
None,
he repeated.
Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses come to our door and say, your Bible is wrong in the King James Version of 1 John 5:7-8, where it talks about the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one. They'll say, that's not in the earliest manuscripts. And that's true enough. I think that these words are found in only about 7 or 8 copies, all from the 15th or 16th century. I acknowledge that this is not part of what the author of 1 John was inspired to write. But that does not dislodge the firmly witnessed testimony of the Bible to the doctrine of the Trinity. At the baptism of Jesus, the Father speaks, his beloved Son is baptized, and the Holy Spirit descends on him. At the ending of 2 Corinthians, Paul says, may the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all. There are many places where the Trinity is represented.
So the variations, when they occur, tend to be minor rather than substantive?
Yes, yes, that's correct. And scholars work very carefully to try to resolve them by getting back to the original meaning. The more significant variations do not overthrow any doctrine of the church. Any good Bible will have notes that will alert the reader to variant readings of any consequence. But again, these are rare.
So rare that scholars Norman Geisler and William Nix conclude, the New Testament, then, has not only survived in more manuscripts than any other book from antiquity, but it has survived in a purer form than any other great book, a form that is 99.5% pure. However, even if it's true that the transmission of the New Testament through history has been unprecedented in its reliability, how do we know that we have the whole picture? What about allegations that church councils squelched equally legitimate documents because they didn't like the picture of Jesus they portrayed? How do we know that the 27 books of the New Testament represent the best and most reliable information? Why is it that our Bibles contain Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but many other ancient Gospels, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of the Egyptians, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of Nativity of Mary, were excluded? It was time to turn to the question of the canon, a term that comes from a Greek word meaning rule, norm, or standard, and that describes the books that have become accepted as official in the Church and included in the New Testament. Metzger is considered a leading authority in that field. A high degree of unanimity. How did the early church leaders determine which books would be considered authoritative and which would be discarded? I asked. What criteria did they use in determining which documents would be included in the New Testament?
Basically, the early church had three criteria, he said. First, the books must have apostolic authority, that is, they must have been written either by apostles themselves, who were eyewitnesses to what they wrote about, or by followers of apostles. So in the case of Mark and Luke, while they weren't among the 12 disciples, early tradition has it that Mark was a helper of Peter and Luke was an associate of Paul. Second, there was the criterion of conformity to what was called the rule of faith. That is, was the document congruent with the basic Christian tradition that the Church recognized as normative? And third, there was the criterion of whether a document had had continuous acceptance and usage by the Church at large. They merely applied those criteria and let the chips fall where they may, I asked.
Well, it wouldn't be accurate to say that these criteria were simply applied in a mechanical fashion, he replied. There were certainly different opinions about which criterion should be given the most weight. But what's remarkable is that even though the fringes of the canon remained unsettled for a while, there was actually a high degree of unanimity concerning the greater part of the New Testament within the first two centuries. And this was true among very diverse congregations, scattered over a wide area.
So, I said, the four Gospels we have in the New Testament today met those criteria while others didn't?
Yes, he said. It was, if I may put it this way, an example of survival of the fittest. In talking about the canon, Arthur Darby Nock used to tell his students at Harvard, "The most traveled roads in Europe are the best roads. That's why they're so heavily traveled."
That's a good analogy. British commentator William Barclay said it this way, "It is the simple truth to say that the New Testament books became canonical because no one could stop them doing so." We can be confident that no other ancient books can compare with the New Testament in terms of importance for Christian history or doctrine. When one studies the early history of the canon, one walks away convinced that the New Testament contains the best sources for the history of Jesus. Those who discerned the limits of the canon had a clear and balanced perspective of the gospel of Christ. Just read these other documents for yourself. They're written later than the four gospels, in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, even 6th century, long after Jesus. And they're generally quite banal. They carry names like the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Mary that are unrelated to their real authorship. On the other hand, the four Gospels in the New Testament were readily accepted with remarkable unanimity as being authentic in the story they told. Yet I knew that some liberal scholars, most notably members of the well-publicized Jesus Seminar, believe the Gospel of Thomas ought to be elevated to equal status with the four traditional Gospels. Did this mysterious Gospel fall victim to political wars within the church, eventually being excluded because of its unpopular doctrines? I decided I'd better probe Metzger on this point. The secret words of Jesus. Dr. Metzger, the Gospel of Thomas, which was among the Nag Hammadi documents found in Egypt in 1945, claims it contains the secret words which the living Jesus spoke and Didymus Judas Thomas wrote down. Why was it excluded by the church? Metzger was thoroughly acquainted with the work. The Gospel of Thomas came to light in a 5th-century copy in Coptic, which I've translated into English, he said. It contains 114 sayings attributed to Jesus, but no narrative of what he did, and seems to have been written in Greek in Syria about AD 140. In some cases, I think this gospel correctly reports what Jesus said, with slight modifications. This was certainly an intriguing statement. Please elaborate, I said. Well, for instance, in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, "A city built on a high hill cannot be hidden." Here the adjective high is added, but the rest reads like Matthew's gospel. Or Jesus says, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Render to God the things that are God's. Render to me the things that are mine." In this case, the later phrase has been added. However, there are some things in Thomas that are totally alien to the canonical Gospels. Jesus says, "Split wood, I am there. Lift up a stone, and you will find me there." That's pantheism. The idea that Jesus is coterminous with the substance of this world, that's contrary to anything in the canonical Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas ends with a note saying, "Let Mary go away from us, because women are not worthy of life." Jesus is quoted as saying, "Lo, I shall lead her in order to make her a male, so that she too may become a living spirit, resembling you males. For every woman who makes herself male will enter into the kingdom of heaven." Metzger's eyebrows shot up as if he were surprised at what he had just uttered. Now, this is not the Jesus we know from the 4 canonical Gospels, he said emphatically. I asked, what about the charge that Thomas was purposefully excluded by church councils in some sort of conspiracy to silence it? That's just not historically accurate, came Metzger's response. What the synods and councils did in the 5th century and following was to ratify what already had been accepted by high and low Christians alike. It is not right to say that the Gospel of Thomas was excluded by some fiat on the part of a council. The right way to put it is, the Gospel of Thomas excluded itself. It did not harmonize with other testimony about Jesus that early Christians accepted as trustworthy. So you would disagree with anyone who would try to elevate Thomas to the same status as that of the 4 Gospels? I asked. Yes, I would very much disagree. I think the early church exercised a judicious act in discarding it. To take it up now, it seems to me, would be to accept something that's less valid than the other Gospels. Now, don't get me wrong. I think the Gospel of Thomas is an interesting document, but it's mixed up with pantheistic and anti-feminist statements that certainly deserve to be given the left foot of fellowship, if you know what I mean. You have to understand that the canon was not the result of a series of contests involving church politics. The canon is rather the separation that came about because of the intuitive insight of Christian believers. They could hear the voice of the Good Shepherd in the Gospel of John. They could hear it only in a muffled and distorted way in the Gospel of Thomas, mixed in with a lot of other things. When the pronouncement was made about the canon, it merely ratified what the general sensitivity of the church had already determined. You see, the canon is a list of authoritative books more than it is an authoritative list of books. These documents didn't derive their authority from being selected. Each one was authoritative before anyone gathered them together. The early church merely listened and sensed that these were authoritative accounts. For somebody now to say that the canon emerged only after councils and synods made these pronouncements would be like saying, let's get several academies of musicians to make a pronouncement that the music of Bach and Beethoven is wonderful. I would say thank you for nothing. We knew that before the pronouncement was made. We know it because of sensitivity to what is good music and what is not. The same with the canon. Even so, I pointed out that some New Testament books, notably James, Hebrews, and Revelation, were more slowly accepted into the canon than others. Should we therefore be suspicious of them? I asked.
Well, to my mind, that just shows how careful the early church was, he replied. They weren't gung-ho, sweeping in every last document that happened to have anything about Jesus in it. This shows deliberation and careful analysis. Of course, even today parts of the Syrian church refuse to accept the book of Revelation, yet the people belonging to that church are Christian believers. From my point of view, I accept the book of Revelation as a wonderful part of the scriptures. He shook his head.
I think they impoverish themselves by not accepting it. The unrivaled New Testament. Metzger had been persuasive. No serious doubts lingered concerning whether the New Testament's text had been reliably preserved for us through the centuries. One of Metzger's distinguished predecessors at Princeton Theological Seminary, Benjamin Warfield, who held 4 doctorates and taught systematic theology until his death in 1921, put it this way. If we compare the present state of the New Testament text with that of any other ancient writing, we must declare it to be marvelously correct. Such has been the care with which the New Testament has been copied, a care which has doubtless grown out of true reverence for its holy words. The New Testament is unrivaled among ancient writings in the purity of its text as actually transmitted and kept in use. In terms of which documents were accepted into the New Testament, generally there has never been any serious dispute about the authoritative nature of 20 of the New Testament's 27 books, from Matthew through Philemon, plus 1 Peter and 1 John. This, of course, includes the 4 Gospels that represent Jesus' biographies. The remaining 7 books, though questioned for a time by some early church leaders, were finally and fully recognized by the church generally, according to Geisler and Nix. As for the pseudepigraphia, the proliferation of Gospels, epistles, and apocalypses in the first few centuries after Jesus, including the Gospels of Nicodemus, Barnabas, Bartholomew, Andrew, the Epistle of Paul to the Laodiceans, the Apocalypse of Stephen, and others, they are fanciful and heretical, neither genuine nor valuable as a whole, and virtually no orthodox father, canon, or council considered them to be authoritative or deserving of inclusion in the New Testament. In fact, I accepted Metzger's challenge by reading many of them myself. Compared with the careful, sober, precise eyewitness quality of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these works truly deserve the description they received from Eusebius, the early church historian. Totally absurd and impious. They were too far removed from Jesus' ministry to contribute anything meaningful to my investigation, having been written as late as the 5th and 6th centuries, and their often mythical qualities disqualify them from being historically credible. With all that established, the time had arrived for my investigation to advance to its next phase. I was curious, how much evidence is there for this miracle-working first-century carpenter outside the Gospels? Do ancient historians confirm or contradict the New Testament's claims about his life, teachings, and miracles? I knew this required a trip to Ohio to visit one of the country's leading scholars in that field. As we stood, I thanked Dr. Metzger for his time and expertise. He smiled warmly and offered to walk me downstairs. I didn't want to consume any more of his Saturday afternoon, but my curiosity wouldn't let me leave Princeton without satisfying myself about one remaining issue. All these decades of scholarship, of study, of writing textbooks, of delving into the minutiae of the New Testament text, what has all this done to your personal faith? I asked.
Oh, he said, sounding happy to discuss the topic. It has increased the basis of my personal faith to see the firmness with which these materials have come down to us, with a multiplicity of copies, some of which are very, very ancient.
So, I started to say, scholarship has not diluted your faith? He jumped in before I could finish my sentence.
On the contrary, he stressed, it has built it. I've asked questions all my life. I've dug into the text. I've studied this thoroughly. And today I know with confidence that my trust in Jesus has been well placed.
He paused while his eyes surveyed my face. Then he added, for emphasis,
very well placed.
4. The corroborating evidence. Harry Aylman turned and stabbed his finger at me.
You,
he sputtered, spitting out the word with disgust.
Why do you keep writing those things about me?
Then he spun around and disappeared down a back stairwell to escape the reporters who were pursuing him through the courthouse. Actually, it was hard to be a crime reporter in Chicago during the 1970s and not write about Harry Aylman. He was, after all, the quintessential crime syndicate hitman. And Chicagoans, in a perverse way, love to read about the mob. Prosecutors desperately wanted to put Aylman in prison for one of the cold-blooded executions they suspected he had committed on behalf of his syndicate bosses. The problem, of course, was the difficulty of finding anyone willing to testify against a mobster of Aylman's frightening reputation. Then came their big break. One of Aylman's former cronies, Luis Almeida, was arrested on his way to murder a labor official in Pennsylvania. Convicted of weapons charges and sentenced to a decade in prison, Almeida agreed to testify against Aylman in the unsolved slaying of a Teamsters Union shop steward in Chicago if prosecutors would agree to show leniency toward Almeida. This meant Almeida had a motive to cooperate, which would undoubtedly tarnish his credibility to some degree. Prosecutors realized they would need to bolster his testimony to ensure a conviction, so they went searching for someone to corroborate Almeida's account. Webster's dictionary defines corroborate this way: to make more certain, confirm. He corroborated my account of the accident. Corroborative evidence supports other testimony. It affirms or backs up the essential elements of an eyewitness account. It can be a public record, a photograph, or additional testimony from a second or third person. It can verify a person's entire testimony or just key parts of it. In effect, corroborative evidence acts like the support wires that keep a tall antenna straight and unwavering. The more corroborative evidence, the stronger and more secure the case. But where would prosecutors find corroboration of Almeida's story? It came from a surprising source, a quiet, law-abiding citizen named Bobby Lowe told investigators he had been walking his dog when he saw Aylman murder the union steward. Despite Aylman's bone-chilling notoriety, Lowe agreed to back up Almeida's story by testifying against the mobster. The power of corroboration. At Aylman's trial, Lowe and Almeida mesmerized jurors with their stories. Almeida's account of driving the getaway car dovetailed with Lowe's straightforward description of seeing Aylman murder his victim on a public sidewalk the evening of September 27, 1972. Prosecutors thought they had woven an airtight case against the feared hitman, yet throughout the trial they sensed something was amiss. Their skepticism first surfaced when Aylman decided against having a jury trial, opting instead to have a judge hear his case. At the end of the trial, the prosecutor's worst suspicions were realized. Despite compelling testimony by Lowe and Almeida, The judge ended up declaring Aylman innocent and letting him go free. What had happened? Remember, this took place in Cook County, Illinois, where corruption so often lurks. Years later, it was revealed that the judge had been slipped $10,000 in return for the acquittal. When an FBI informant disclosed the bribe, the then-retired judge committed suicide, and prosecutors refiled the murder charge against Aylman. By the time the second trial was held, the law had been changed so that prosecutors could demand that a jury hear the case. That's what they did. And finally, a full 25 years after the murder, Aylman was found guilty and sentenced to 100 to 300 years in prison. In spite of the delays, the Aylman saga shows how significant corroborative evidence can be. And the same is true in dealing with historical issues. We've already heard, through Dr. Craig Blomberg's testimony, that in the Gospels there is excellent eyewitness evidence for the life, teachings, death, and resurrection of Jesus. But is there any other evidence to corroborate that? Are there writings outside the Gospels that affirm or support any of the essentials about Jesus or early Christianity? In other words, is there any additional documentation that can help seal the case for Christ, as Bobby Lowe's testimony sealed the case against Harry Aylman? The answer, according to our next witness, is yes. And the amount and quality of that evidence may very well surprise you. The third interview, Edwin M. Yamauchi, Ph.D. As I entered the imposing brick building that houses the office of Edwin Yamauchi at Miami University in picturesque Oxford, Ohio, I walked underneath a stone arch bearing this inscription, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free." As one of the country's leading experts in ancient history, Yamauchi has been on a quest for historical truth for much of his life. Born in Hawaii in 1937, the son of immigrants from Okinawa, Yamauchi started from humble beginnings. His father died just before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, leaving his mother to earn a meager living as a maid for wealthy families. While lacking formal education herself, she encouraged her son to read and study, giving him beautifully illustrated books that instilled in him a lifelong love of learning. Certainly, his academic accomplishments have been impressive. After earning a bachelor's degree in Hebrew and Hellenistics, Yamauchi received master's and doctoral degrees in Mediterranean studies from Brandeis University. He has been awarded 8 fellowships from the Rutgers Research Council, National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Philosophical Society, and others. He has studied 22 languages, including Arabic, Chinese, Egyptian, Russian, Syriac, Ugaritic, and even Comanche. He has delivered 71 papers before learned societies, lectured at more than 100 seminaries, universities, and colleges, including Yale, Princeton, and Cornell, served as chairman and then president of the Institute for Biblical Research and president of the Conference on Faith and History, and published 80 articles in 37 scholarly journals. In 1968, he participated in the first excavations of the Herodian Temple in Jerusalem, revealing evidence of the temple's destruction in A.D. 70. Archaeology has also been the theme of several of his books, including The Stones and the Scriptures, The Scriptures and Archaeology, and The World of the First Christians. Though born into a Buddhist background, Yamauchi has been following Jesus ever since 1952, the year I was born. I was especially curious to see whether his long-term commitment to Christ would color his assessment of the historical evidence. In other words, would he scrupulously stick to the facts or be tempted to draw conclusions that went beyond where the evidence warranted? I found Yamauchi to have a gentle and unassuming demeanor. Although generally soft-spoken, he's intensely focused. He provides thorough and detailed answers to questions, often pausing to supplement his verbal response by offering photocopies of scholarly articles he has written on the topic. A good scholar knows you can never have too much data. Inside his book-cluttered office, in the heart of a heavily wooded campus ablaze in autumn colors, we sat down to talk about the topic that still brings a glint to his eyes, even after so many years of research and teaching. affirming the Gospels. Because of my interview with Blomberg, I didn't want to suggest that we needed to go beyond the Gospels in order to find reliable evidence concerning Jesus. So I started by asking Yamauchi this question. As an historian, could you give me your assessment of the historical reliability of the Gospels themselves?
On the whole, the Gospels are excellent sources, he replied. As a matter of fact, they're the most trustworthy, complete, and reliable sources for Jesus. The incidental sources really don't add much detailed information. However, they are valuable as corroborative evidence.
Okay, that's what I want to discuss. The corroborative evidence, I said. Let's be honest. Some people scoff at how much there really is. For example, in 1979, Charles Templeton wrote a novel called Act of God, in which a fictional archaeologist made a statement that reflects the beliefs of a lot of people. I pulled out the book and read the relevant paragraph. The Christian Church bases its claims mostly on the teachings of an obscure young Jew with messianic pretensions who, let's face it, didn't make much of an impression in his lifetime. There isn't a single word about him in secular history, not a word. No mention of him by the Romans, not so much as a reference by Josephus. Now, I said a little pointedly, that doesn't sound as if there's much corroboration of the life of Jesus outside the Bible. Yamauchi smiled and shook his head.
Templeton's archaeologist is simply mistaken, he replied in a dismissive tone, because we do have very, very important references to Jesus in Josephus and Tacitus. The Gospels themselves say that many who heard him, even members of his own family, did not believe in Jesus during his lifetime, yet he made such an impression that today Jesus is remembered everywhere, whereas Herod the Great, Pontius Pilate, and other ancient rulers are not as widely known. So he certainly did make an impression on those who believed in him. He paused, then added, he did not, of course, among those who did not believe in him.
Testimony by a traitor. Templeton and Yamauchi had both mentioned Josephus, a first-century historian who's well-known among scholars, but whose name is unfamiliar to most people today. Give me some background about him, I said, and tell me how his testimony provides corroboration concerning Jesus.
Yes, of course, Yamauchi answered as he crossed his legs and settled deeper into his chair. Josephus was a very important Jewish historian of the first century. He was born in A.D. 37, and he wrote most of his four works toward the end of the first century. In his autobiography, he defended his behavior in the Jewish-Roman War, which took place from A.D. 66 to 74. You see, he had surrendered to the Roman general Vespasian during the siege of Jotapata, even though many of his colleagues committed suicide rather than give up. The professor chuckled and said, Josephus decided it wasn't God's will for him to commit suicide. He then became a defender of the Romans.
Josephus sounded like a colorful character. I wanted more details about him so I could better understand his motivations and prejudices. Paint me a portrait of him, I said.
Well, he was a priest, a Pharisee, and he was somewhat egotistical. His most ambitious work was called The Antiquities, which was a history of the Jewish people from creation until his time. He probably completed it in about A.D. 93.
As you can imagine from his collaboration with the hated Romans, Josephus was extremely disliked by his fellow Jews. But he became very popular among Christians because in his writings he refers to James, the brother of Jesus, and to Jesus himself.
Here was our first example of corroboration for Jesus outside the Gospels.
Tell me about those references, I said, replied Yamauchi.
In the Antiquities, he describes how a high priest named Ananias took advantage of the death of the Roman governor Festus, who is also mentioned in the New Testament, in order to have James killed.
He leaned over to his bookshelf, pulled out a thick volume, and flipped to a page whose location he seemed to know by heart.
Here it is. he convened a meeting of the Sanhedrin and brought before them a man named James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, and certain others. He accused them of having transgressed the law and delivered them up to be stoned. "I know of no scholar," Yamauchi asserted confidently, "who has successfully disputed this passage." L. H. Feldman noted that if this had been a later Christian addition to the text, it would have likely been more laudatory of James. So here you have a reference to the brother of Jesus, who had apparently been converted by the appearance of the risen Christ, if you compare John 7:5 and 1 Corinthians 15:7, and corroboration of the fact that some people considered Jesus to be the Christ, which means the Anointed One or Messiah. There lived Jesus. I knew that Josephus had written an even lengthier section about Jesus, which is called the Testimonium Flavianum. I knew, too, that this passage was among the most hotly disputed in ancient literature, because on its surface it appears to provide sweeping corroboration of Jesus' life, miracles, death, and resurrection. But is it authentic? Or has it been doctored through the years by people favorable to Jesus? I asked Yamauchi for his opinion, and it was instantly clear I had tapped into an area of high interest for him. He uncrossed his legs and sat up straight in his chair. "This is a fascinating passage," he said with enthusiasm, leaning forward, book in hand. "But yes, it is controversial." With that, he read it to me. "About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Christ. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing among us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared to them, restored to life, for the prophets of God had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him, and the tribe of Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared." The wealth of corroboration for Jesus was readily evident. "You agreed this was controversial. What have scholars concluded about this passage?" I asked.
"Scholarship has gone through three trends about it," he said. "For obvious reasons, the early Christians thought it was a wonderful and thoroughly authentic attestation of Jesus and his resurrection. They loved it. Then, the entire passage was questioned by at least some scholars during the Enlightenment. But today there's a remarkable consensus among both Jewish and Christian scholars that the passage as a whole is authentic, although there may be some interpolations."
I raised an eyebrow. "Interpolations. Would you define what you mean by that?"
"That means early Christian copyists inserted some phrases that a Jewish writer like Josephus would not have written," Yamauchi said. He pointed to a sentence in the book. "For instance, the first line says, 'About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man.' Now, that phrase is not normally used of Jesus by Christians, so it seems authentic for Josephus. But the next phrase says, 'If indeed one ought to call him a man.' This implies Jesus was more than human, which appears to be an interpolation."
I nodded to let him know I was following him so far.
"It goes on to say, 'For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks.' That seems to be quite in accord with the vocabulary Josephus uses elsewhere, and it's generally considered authentic. But then there's this unambiguous statement, 'He was the Christ.' That seems to be an interpolation."
"Because," I interrupted, "Josephus says in his reference to James that Jesus was called the Christ."
"That's right," said Yamauchi. "It's unlikely Josephus would have flatly said Jesus was the Messiah here, when elsewhere he merely said he was considered to be the Messiah by his followers. The next part of the passage, which talks about Jesus' trial and crucifixion and the fact that his followers still loved him, is unexceptional and considered genuine. Then there's this phrase, 'On the third day he appeared to them, restored to life.' Again, This is a clear declaration of belief in the resurrection, and thus it's unlikely that Josephus wrote it. So these three elements seem to have been interpolations.
What's the bottom line? I asked.
That the passage in Josephus probably was originally written about Jesus, although without those three points I mentioned. But even so, Josephus corroborates important information about Jesus, that he was the martyred leader of the church in Jerusalem, and that he was a wise teacher who had established a wide and lasting following, despite the fact that he had been crucified under Pilate at the instigation of some of the Jewish leaders.
The importance of Josephus. While these references did offer some important, independent verification about Jesus, I wondered why an historian like Josephus wouldn't have said more about such an important figure of the first century. I knew that some skeptics, like Boston University philosopher Michael Martin, have made this same critique. So I asked for Yamauchi's reaction to this statement by Martin, who doesn't believe Jesus ever lived.
If Jesus did exist, one would have expected Josephus to have said more about him. It is unexpected that Josephus mentioned him in passing while mentioning other messianic figures and John the Baptist in greater detail.
Yamauchi's response seemed uncharacteristically strong. From time to time, some people have tried to deny the existence of Jesus, but this is really a lost cause, he said with a tone of exasperation. There is overwhelming evidence that Jesus did exist, and these hypothetical questions are really very vacuous and fallacious. But I'd answer by saying this. Josephus was interested in political matters and the struggle against Rome. So for him, John the Baptist was more important because he seemed to pose a greater political threat than did Jesus.
I jumped in. Hold on a second. Aren't there some scholars who have portrayed Jesus as a zealot, or at least sympathetic to the zealots? I asked, referring to a first-century revolutionary group that opposed Rome politically. Yamauchi dismissed the objection with a wave of his hand.
That is a position the Gospels themselves do not support, he replied. Because remember, Jesus didn't even object to paying taxes to the Romans. Therefore, because Jesus and his followers didn't pose an immediate political threat, it's certainly understandable that Josephus isn't more interested in this sect, even though in hindsight it turned out to be very important indeed.
So, in your assessment, how significant are these two references by Josephus?
Highly significant, Yamauchi replied, especially since his accounts of the Jewish war have proved to be very accurate. For example, they've been corroborated through archaeological excavations at Masada as well as by historians like Tacitus. He's considered to be a pretty reliable historian, and his mentioning of Jesus is considered extremely important.
A most mischievous superstition.
Yamauchi had just mentioned the most important Roman historian of the first century, and I wanted to discuss what Tacitus had to say about Jesus and Christianity.
Could you spell out what he corroborates? I asked.
Yamauchi nodded. Tacitus recorded what is probably the most important reference to Jesus outside the New Testament, he said. In A.D. 115, he explicitly states that Nero persecuted the Christians as scapegoats to divert suspicion away from himself for the great fire that had devastated Rome in A.D. 64. Yamauchi stood and walked over to a shelf, scanning it for a certain book.
Yes, here it is, he said, withdrawing a thick volume and leafing through it until he found the right passage, which he then read to me.
Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. Accordingly, an arrest was first made of all who pleaded guilty. Then, upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind.
I was already familiar with that passage, and I was wondering how Yamauchi would respond to an observation by a leading scholar named J.N.D. Anderson. He speculates that when Tacitus says this mischievous superstition was checked for the moment but later again broke out, he was unconsciously bearing testimony to the belief of early Christians that Jesus had been crucified but then rose from the grave, I said. Do you agree with him? Yamauchi thought for a moment.
This has certainly been the interpretation of some scholars, he replied, seeming to duck my request for his opinion. But then he made a crucial point. Regardless of whether the passage had this specifically in mind, it does provide us with a very remarkable fact, which is this. Crucifixion was the most abhorrent fate that anyone could undergo, and the fact that there was a movement based on a crucified man has to be explained. How can you explain the spread of a religion based on the worship of a man who had suffered the most ignominious death possible? Of course, the Christian answer is that he was resurrected. Others have to come up with some alternative theory if they don't believe that. But none of the alternative views, to my mind, are very persuasive.
I asked him to characterize the weight of Tacitus's writings concerning Jesus.
This is an important testimony by an unsympathetic witness to the success and spread of Christianity, based on an historical figure, Jesus, who was crucified under Pontius Pilate, he said. And it's significant that Tacitus reported that an immense multitude held so strongly to their beliefs that they were willing to die rather than recant,
chanting, as if to a god. I knew that another Roman, called Pliny the Younger, had also referred to Christianity in his writings. He corroborated some important matters too, didn't he? I asked.
That's right. He was the nephew of Pliny the Elder, the famous encyclopedist who died in the eruption of Vesuvius in A.D. 79. Pliny the Younger became governor of Bithynia in northwestern Turkey. Much of his correspondence with his friend, Emperor Trajan, has been preserved to the present time.
Yamauchi pulled out a photocopy of a book page, saying,
In Book 10 of these letters, he specifically refers to the Christians he has arrested. I have asked them if they are Christians, and if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time with a warning of the punishment awaiting them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for execution, for whatever the nature of their admission, I am convinced that their stubbornness and unshakable obstinacy ought not to go unpunished. They also declared that the sum total of their guilt or error amounted to no more than this. They had met regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately amongst themselves in honor of Christ, as if to a god, and also to bind themselves by oath, not for any criminal purpose, but to abstain from theft, robbery, and adultery. This made me decide it was all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from two slave women, whom they called deaconesses. I found nothing but a degenerate sort of cult carried to extravagant lengths.
How important is this reference? I asked.
Very important. It was probably written about A.D. 111, and it attests to the rapid spread of Christianity both in the city and in the rural area, among every class of persons, slave women as well as Roman citizens, since he also says that he sends Christians who are Roman citizens to Rome for trial. And it talks about the worship of Jesus as God, that Christians maintained high ethical standards and that they were not easily swayed from their beliefs.
The day the earth went dark. To me, one of the most problematic references in the New Testament is where the gospel writers claim that the earth went dark during part of the time that Jesus hung on the cross. Wasn't this merely a literary device to stress the significance of the crucifixion and not a reference to an actual historical occurrence? After all, if darkness had fallen over the earth, wouldn't there be at least some mention of this extraordinary event outside the Bible? However, Dr. Gary Habermas has written about an historian named Thallus, who in A.D. 52 wrote a history of the Eastern Mediterranean world since the Trojan War. Although Thallus's work has been lost, it was quoted by Julius Africanus in about A.D. 221, and it made reference to the darkness that the Gospels had written about. Could this, I asked, be independent corroboration of this biblical claim? Explained Yamauchi. In this passage, Julius Africanus says, Thallus, in the third book of his histories, explains away the darkness as an eclipse of the sun, unreasonably, as it seems to me. So Thallus apparently was saying, yes, there had been darkness at the time of the crucifixion, and he speculated it had been caused by an eclipse. Africanus then argues that it couldn't have been an eclipse, given when the crucifixion occurred. Yamauchi reached over to his desk to retrieve a piece of paper. Let me quote what scholar Paul Meyer said about the darkness in a footnote in his 1968 book Pontius Pilate, he said, reading these words. This phenomenon, evidently, was visible in Rome, Athens, and other Mediterranean cities. According to Tertullian, it was a cosmic or world event. Phlegon, a Greek author from Caria, writing a chronology soon after 137 A.D., reported that in the fourth year of the 202nd Olympiad, i.e., 33 A.D., there was the greatest eclipse of the sun, and that it became night in the sixth hour of the day, i.e., noon, so that stars even appeared in the heavens. There was a great earthquake in Bithynia, and many things were overturned in Nicaea. Yamauchi concluded, so there is, as Paul Meyer points out, non-biblical attestation of the darkness that occurred at the time of Jesus' crucifixion. Apparently, some found the need to try to give it a natural explanation by saying it was an eclipse. A Portrait of Pilate. Yamauchi's mentioning of Pilate reminded me of how some critics have questioned the accuracy of the Gospels because of the way they portray this Roman leader. While the New Testament paints him as being vacillating and willing to yield to the pressures of a Jewish mob by executing Jesus, other historical accounts picture him as being obstinate and inflexible. Doesn't this represent a contradiction between the Bible and secular historians? I asked.
No, it really doesn't, said Yamauchi. Meyer's study of Pilate shows that his protector or patron was Sejanus, and that Sejanus fell from power in A.D. 31 because he was plotting against the emperor.
I was puzzled. What does that have to do with anything? I asked.
Well, this loss would have made Pilate's position very weak in A.D. 33, which is most likely when Jesus was crucified, the professor responded. So it would certainly be understandable that Pilate would have been reluctant to offend the Jews at that time and to get into further trouble with the emperor. That means the biblical description is most likely accurate.
Other Jewish accounts. Having talked primarily about Roman corroboration of Jesus, I wanted to turn a corner at this point and discuss whether any other Jewish accounts besides that of Josephus verify anything about Jesus. I asked Yamauchi about references to Jesus in the Talmud, an important Jewish work finished about A.D. 500 that incorporates the Mishnah, compiled about A.D. 200.
Jews, as a whole, did not go into great detail about heretics, he replied. There are a few passages in the Talmud that mention Jesus, calling him a false Messiah who practiced magic and who was justly condemned to death. They also repeat the rumor that Jesus was born of a Roman soldier and Mary, suggesting there was something unusual about his birth.
So, I said, in a negative way, these Jewish references do corroborate some things about Jesus.
Yes, that's right. Professor M. Wilcox put it this way in an article that appeared in a scholarly reference work. The Jewish traditional literature, although it mentions Jesus only quite sparingly, and must in any case be used with caution, supports the gospel claim that he was a healer and miracle worker, even though it ascribes these activities to sorcery. In addition, it preserves the recollection that he was a teacher and that he had disciples, five of them,
and that, at least in the earlier rabbinic period, not all of the sages had finally made up their minds that he was a heretic or a deceiver.
Evidence apart from the Bible. Although we were finding quite a few references to Jesus outside the Gospels, I was wondering why there were not even more of them. While I knew that few historical documents from the first century have survived, I asked, overall, shouldn't we have expected to find more about Jesus in ancient writings outside the Bible?
When people begin religious movements, it's often not until many generations later that people record things about them,
Yamauchi said.
But the fact is that we have better historical documentation for Jesus than for the founder of any other ancient religion.
That caught me off guard.
Really?
Can you elaborate on that?
For example, although the Gathas of Zoroaster, about 1000 BC, are believed to be authentic, most of the Zoroastrian scriptures were not put into writing until after the 3rd century AD. The most popular Parsi biography of Zoroaster was written in AD 1278. The scriptures of Buddha, who lived in the 6th century BC, were not put into writing until after the Christian era, and the first biography of Buddha was written in the 1st century AD. Although we have the sayings of Muhammad, who lived from AD 570 to 632 in the Quran, his biography was not written until 767, more than a full century after his death. So the situation with Jesus is unique and quite impressive in terms of how much we can learn about him aside from the New Testament.
I wanted to pick up on that theme and summarize what we had gleaned about Jesus so far from non-biblical sources. Let's pretend we didn't have any of the New Testament or other Christian writings, I said. Even without them, what would we be able to conclude about Jesus from ancient non-Christian sources, such as Josephus, the Talmud, Tacitus, Pliny the Younger, and others? Yamauchi smiled.
We would still have a considerable amount of important historical evidence. In fact, it would provide a kind of outline for the life of Jesus, he said.
Then he went on, raising a finger to emphasize each point.
We would know that, first, Jesus was a Jewish teacher. Second, many people believed that he performed healings and exorcisms. Third, some people believed he was the Messiah. Fourth, he was rejected by the Jewish leaders. Fifth, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Sixth, despite this shameful death, his followers, who believed that he was still alive, spread beyond Palestine so that there were multitudes of them in Rome by AD 64. And seventh, all kinds of people from the cities and countryside, men and women, slave and free, worshipped him as God.
This was indeed an impressive amount of independent corroboration. And not only can the contours of Jesus' life be reconstructed apart from the Bible, but there's even more that can be gleaned about him from materials so old that it actually predates the Gospels themselves.
This concludes this disc. Please proceed to disc 4 for the continuation of the program.